The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Campus Voices here on WVUD, where Ryan Thornton and Sam O'Donnell and I have invited a professor who taught a class we just could not resist.
Today we're sitting down with Dr. Emerald Christopher Byrd, who researches the socio-political position of Black women in the United States, and she teaches WAMS classes here.
What caught our attention was one of the courses you teach, WAMS 260, Women, Cultural Representations, Hip-Hop, and Feminism, a topic that lots of people might not find related. How are hip-hop and feminism related?
That's a great question, and it's the question I get a lot. But if we think about the actual definition of feminism and the idea that it's to end inequality based on gender, race, sexuality, and other identities, then we can actually see how hip hop and feminism are connected. In particular, the history and evolution of hip hop. And when we think about hip hop, a lot of times we think about the current manifestations, the current misogynistic language, the current misogynistic videos that we see, and that's mainstream. So in my class, we talk about the history of hip hop, its evolution, and women's involvement in actually laying the platform for hip hop. And largely women are invisible when we talk about how hip hop began in the United States.
Right. And it seems like you have women like Nicki Minaj, Beyonce coming to the forefront of hip hop. Are they, would you call them the new face of this hip hop feminism, or is there a face at all?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I would say at the beginning, you had rappers like Queen Latifah talking about UNITY and unity and not being called a certain name by men in a derogatory way. And then we moved from Queen Latifah to people like MC Light. And then in the 90s, we had Lil' Kim and Foxy Brown. So I would say today you have people in the mainstream like Nicki Minaj, Beyonce, even Remy Ma and Cardi B. But I think the bigger question is why some women aren't as represented in hip hop today as they were before. And I think that has a lot to do with the commercialization of hip hop and the whole idea that sex and misogyny seems to sell more.
What are some or who are some of the artists you guys look at in your class then?
So I think students come to the class for different reasons. I think when they initially come, they think we're only going to talk about current rap music, but we talk about hip hop culture in its entirety. So that includes emceeing, graffiti, b-boying and b-girling and dancing, as well as rap music. So currently, the students are very, very into Cardi B. So we're talking a lot about her, but in particular, how class intersects with race and gender in hip hop. Most of the conversations today around Cardi B happens to be around her language and how she interviews and how she doesn't seem to be as polished as people would like her to be. And we argue in class that that's actually a good thing because part of the disconnect that people have with class is this whole respectable politics that people have to present in a certain way. And I think Cardi B is going against that grain.
And when you talk about feminism and hip hop, we think of Black women. Mm-hmm. And there is, for Black women, that intersectional feminism that is becoming more in the mainstream today with campaigns like the Say Her Name campaign, bringing light to issues with Black women who haven't really been noticed as far as police brutality issues go. Mm-hmm. For Black women in hip hop, where does this specific intersectional feminism come to play?
I think that's a great question, mostly because I think the term currently when it comes to intersectional feminism or intersectionality is the new buzzword. So before it was diversity. And if you just have people in a room who are from different backgrounds, that somehow that equals diversity. Intersectionality is very important, but I think how we define it and how we implement it tends to not always match up very well. There have been scholars such as Joan Morgan, and she wrote an excellent book in the 90s called When Chickenheads Come Home to Roost, and she defines hip-hop feminism in that. And basically what she's talking about is how there are these generation divides between her and some of the, quote, foremothers of intersectionality. So bell hooks, Angela Davis, and other authors and scholars. And what she's getting at is this idea that she lives their feminist privilege, this idea that they fought in the women's movement, they fought in the civil rights movement, and now because of their fight, she has certain privileges that women didn't always have, in particular Black women. Now that the generation is different, there's a different need, there's a different feminism that's needed, and part is looking at the gray areas. So she talks about this Black and white mentality, that it's either this or that. And sometimes that's not the case. So intersectional feminism really looks at the multiple identities of individuals and how those identities intersect with each other. Race, gender, class, sexuality. And for Joan Morgan and people like myself who talk about intersectional feminism, that comes up in hip hop, this idea that we can listen to music, appreciate it, but also find the complexities in it and also problematize it in different ways.
In the history of pop music of all kinds, it's often been sort of a misogynist history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just the hip-hop movement.
Right.
It's the whole pop movement, even jazz. I mean, yes. It's a misogynist world out there.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we talk about that because a lot of times the genre of rap music gets just a bad rap entirely. This whole idea that it's the only genre that exists where misogyny takes place. But if you listen to country music, you can find misogyny in country music. And rock music and pop music, I do think, and some scholars have challenged this a little bit, that because certain bodies utilize rap music, whether it's African Americans, Latinos, or the working class, that somehow there's more of a spotlight on rap music when it comes to misogyny.
You mentioned that it's not just rap music where like misogynist type lyrics exist. Mm-hmm. How do you think that really started then in music as a whole?
Mm-hmm. So I think music is a microcosm of what's happening in society at large. So when we see misogyny in our everyday lives, it's no wonder that it's reflected in our music. So it's no surprise to see it there. So I don't think it necessarily started in music on its own. I believe that part of it is a reflection on how women are treated in society, and it therefore comes out in music.
And when we talk about society, you do research on generational feminism. As society changes, feminism changes with it. What's changing in feminism today?
Mm-hmm. One of the better moments that I saw from the Women's March in January was this pushback, because when they started with the march, they initially publicized it as the Million Women's March. And that march actually had already taken place. And it was years ago in the 90s where Black women organized to march on Washington. And when people got on Twitter and other social media platforms to kind of express their outrage that there was no background search on this, the platform from the Women's March began to change a little bit. That's where I think the generational feminism comes into play, this idea that we can actually express ourselves in different ways via social media mostly, but giving recognition that you're not expected to know it all, but be open when people approach you about how you might have something or do something that's problematic. The recognition at the march that there were different races, different sexualities, different class present is what I think is most important about generational feminism. And the last piece on that, when we talk about feminism, there's often this kind of, not necessarily backlash, but this initial gut reaction that we need to be only talking about gender. And I think now more than ever, there's this recognition that feminism encompasses more than gender and that people have multiple identities beyond gender.
So you'd mentioned the Women's March that took place last January. My sister was actually able to go, and she had mentioned that it was really great to see people of different backgrounds and different races and really just different walks of life able to walk for like the same type of purpose. But I know like leading up to the march in the media, everybody was talking about how at first it was more of like a white feminist type movement. Yes. Where really the only people in charge of the movement were not people of color. So how would you say that's important towards like the movement of feminism?
Mm-hmm. So there's this longer history with the women's movement of its lack of inclusion. And we don't always like to talk about it because to talk about it means that there was a problem. And because the women's movement gets so much backlash, part of what people avoid doing is talking about any of the criticism that comes with it. But the women's movement has had a long history of not including women of color and working class women. So the organization and the people that started forming the march, who might have been all white, who were only thinking about certain platforms, it was kind of a reminder of the history of the women's movement and its lack of inclusion. And scholars and activists actually pushed back, and rightfully so, saying that we don't want to repeat the past, because part of the reason why we're where we are today is because of the lack of inclusion previously. I do think they did a good job, but I still think we have a long way to go in recognizing multiple identities.
And we're talking to Dr. Emerald Christopher Bird of the Department of Women and Gender Studies. And you just mentioned the past, and one of your projects was entitled Malcolm X Through the Feminist Lens. Mm-hmm. Can you describe, I don't think many people would look at Malcolm X through a feminist lens. What is that all about?
Yeah, many people don't. So I was invited to speak at this panel, and I was actually very surprised at the title myself. And just as I mentioned earlier about how we don't always like to talk about the problems of the women's movement because we fear that there will be further criticism and then we'll lose focus, I think the same is true for the civil rights movement. Oftentimes, we don't want to criticize our historic leaders because of the progress that they made, but yet they were still problematic in some areas. And although Malcolm X was defiant for his time, although he shed light on racial inequality, there were some issues when it came to gender. And for a long period of time, Black women, Chicana women, and other Latina women didn't have the space to really explore gender issues because race was always taking the forefront in some organizations. And the civil rights movement was no different. And this panel really explored, and part of what I talked about is this idea that we can find the areas that he was good in and other leaders were great at and the progress that they made. But we can also be there to critique them and challenge our future leaders in addressing things like gender.
That gets at a lot of people's point of view regarding historical figures and current political figures, where, you know, you have to buy them 100% mm-hmm. or you're our enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very polarizing point of view.
Mm-hmm. It's completely polarizing. And what it does is it puts people on this pedestal so that when they don't adhere to this certain set of criteria, we knock them down completely and disregard them. The reality is we're all complex, and life is complex and nuanced. And to ignore that aspect is actually doing more harm than good, in my opinion.
I know through past observations of the civil rights movement that, and I think this is also true today, lots of people would argue that it's better to fight for one cause at a time.
Mm.
Do you think it's possible to fight for multiple causes at the same time and get the results that everybody wants, or does it have to be one thing at a time?
That's a great question. I have a friend who asked me a question, and it's mostly because her dad was confused. She said, you know, her dad came to her and said, well, why isn't the Women's March just talking about women? Why do we have to talk about sexuality? Why do we have to talk about race? Why do we have to talk about all of these identities? It's just important to stick to one thing. And that's the language that has been historically used for the women's movement, the civil rights movement, that this one thing is important to focus on. But the reality is that we are all complex characters. We can think about our own lived experiences and realize that you're not just a man. You might be a Christian, heterosexual, rich man. And those identities together comprise your experiences and your lived experiences of how people interact with you. So to say that to only focus on gender would actually be stripping a lot of people from their other identities, be it a woman, man, heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, trans. All of those identities forms people's experiences, and they have to navigate the world that way. So when we talk about social issues such as healthcare, education, all of these things make a person's experience very different if they are heterosexual, homosexual, while Black and a woman, for example.
Is it possible really for policymakers to, you know, they focus on one thing at a time.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a tax cut they're looking at. They're looking at one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really possible? I mean, that's one of the things you study for this diverse and complex relationship between us and our different personas and each other. to come up with some kind of meaningful policy?
Mm-hmm. I think, and this is based on my experience working on the Hill at one point, where congressional leaders have their own experience, and it's not realistic to think that they can think of every single person's makeup and identity. It's who they surround themselves with, who do the research, who have those conversations with them, that I think makes all the difference. And one of those differences, one of the examples I can give is the paycheck equality, equal pay. And this whole idea that we usually give one number, we say 77 cents or 78 cents to the dollar, depending on what year the cent is different. But when we actually look at the research, it is white women who make that amount, whereas Black women and Latino women make even less than that. Part of what is challenging is actually getting policymakers to see that you just can't quote one percentage, because it makes a difference when we talk about identity. So I do think it's possible, but it's possible when legislators and policymakers actually speak to those communities and different communities in order to get their input.
Do you think it would help just having more representation in our government as well?
Yes. So I was actually away this past week at a conference, and I wasn't here to see the results from the last election in Virginia in particular. But those historic moments of having someone transgender, of having a different race and ethnicities present in legislation reform, I think is very important. So yes, representation does matter, and it's not about just being at the table, but it's actually incorporating those voices at the table when making policies.
We're talking to Dr. Emerald Christopher Bird of the Department of Women and Gender Studies. You teach a lot about gender, race, and class, mm-hmm. and we live in a time where we have the Black Lives Matter movement, the Say Her Name movement. How have these movements changed the way that you teach these topics to young people in your class?
Coming from women and gender studies, I think a lot of times we not only use research, we talk about our positionality. So where we are in the world and how where we are in the world impacts how we receive information and how we deliver information. So part of the challenge that I have sometimes when I teach is based on my multiple identities and how I am individually impacted by what I see in society, what I see in the media, how people interact with me. And I bring those things to the classroom. I think a lot of times professors tend to separate themselves from students, and we stand there behind our podium and we tell you what to do. You listen. Sometimes we engage with you scholarly, but that's not how I tend to interact with my students. And I think that makes a huge difference. At the end of the day, when my students walk out of the classroom, they're not necessarily thinking that they're going to be a woman in gender studies professor someday. So how can I use the theory that we learn through textbooks and have them apply it in their lives, whether that is if they decide to go be a medical doctor, a lawyer, an activist? Part of my approach with students is not only theory, but theory into actual practice.
Do you ever get anybody in your classes that just full-heartedly disagrees with any of the theories you talk about?
Yes. I had a student one year, and he could not understand how women in the United States felt as though they were not equal or did not have any rights. And the reasoning was, well, men open doors for you, and but you can go to work and you can go to school, so that means that you have rights. And I completely understood where he was coming from to an extent, but what I tend to tell students like him and others that might have a backlash to what I'm saying is that just because you have certain rights doesn't mean those rights are equal. Just because you have the same starting point doesn't mean that you don't have barriers to get to that end point. And I illustrate that, or I attempted to illustrate that, through some current events and basically not only policy, but theory and what's in the textbooks as well.
I had a professor when I was in graduate school, Winifred Horner, a linguist at the University of Missouri, and she talked with us about the different roles that she played when she put on different names. Mm-hmm. She was sometimes Mrs. David Horner. Sometimes she was Dr. Winifred Horner. Sometimes she was Winnie. Mm-hmm. And that she talked with us because, you know, rhetoric and linguistic professors, the kind of thing they talk about. I mean, mm-hmm. she would talk about the differences in the way she'd speak, the rising intonation in certain cases, and, you know, and all this kind of thing. And that's a really important thing for, I would think, for you to communicate to students, is that each one of us has different roles and we interact with each other.
Absolutely. And I love using that as an example in class, where I'll say we all code switch at some point, that, you know, as students, you talk to me in a particular way, but you don't speak to me the way you speak to your mom and dad. You don't speak to me the way you speak to your friends. Just as if you hear me answer the phone and it's my mom on the phone, you might hear my voice change completely. And sometimes students don't always see their professors in that light. They see their professors in one particular way. And in that way, they then separate themselves from not only the instructor, but sometimes actually what they're learning. So the more we can talk about this idea that we wear different hats at different times, I think the more students actually connect with the material and the professor.
I think that we want to talk about these current events, and mm-hmm. I think it's good that we talk about them, but our emotions can get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the kinds of things that come up in your classroom are those same kinds of things that generate this visceral emotion from people.
Mm-hmm.
How do you ensure that the conversation that you have amongst the students stays positive and remains in a way that can actually progress the conversation to a healthy point?
I think affect is very important. And actually, I have taught and published on this whole idea of using anger and using rage in different productive ways. And although people might have that visceral reaction, I actually think anger and rage can actually be constructive. It's just how it's channeled in different ways. So if I have a student who expresses some type of emotion, depending on the student's comfort level and whether or not they're sharing with me or just the class in general, those conversations of, well, let's talk about that emotion and sit with that. And how can that emotion be used in order to create change, in order to think about activism in different ways? Oftentimes when we think about anger and rage, we think about it in very negative ways, but actually people use rage and anger in very constructive ways. That's how people write. That's how people create movements. That's how people go on to Twitter, go on to social media, and actually start a hashtag that then goes viral. So I would say that visceral reactions are not always a bad thing, that if we can actually use those more and actually realize that they're positive in different ways, then we can actually be a little bit more productive in different ways.
We're sitting down with Dr. Emerald Christopher Bird, a professor in the Women's and Gender Studies Department here at the University of Delaware. So I know last night Ryan, Richard, and I were talking about all the different sexual misconduct allegations that have been going around. Mm. Is that honestly something that really surprises you these days?
Unfortunately, no. And I think with the hashtag MeToo, the realization for many people that they're not alone. So it doesn't surprise me, but I do think that a lot of men and women sit with it thinking that no one's going to believe them, that somehow they did something wrong. So unfortunately, it doesn't surprise me. What is a little bit more comforting to see is that there have been more consequences, more holding people accountable based on their actions.
And you have some experience with this as a university administrator for Residence Life. You've adjudicated sexual assault and physical violence cases.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see these things pop up in the mainstream, as someone who's seen these cases through students, how does it make you feel looking back to all those times you've seen it to think just now lots of people are starting to realize that mm-hmm. it's a problem?
That's the frustrating part, right? The idea that there are some people who think that this is a new phenomenon when it's not. And this is when I talk about how social media is actually can be used in a constructive way. And there have been many students that have suffered in silence because of fear that their peers won't believe them, because of social backlash. And what we're seeing in the mainstream now, the part that's slightly frustrating for me is that these tend to be celebrities. They tend to be people with means and money. These tend to be overly white men and women. And oftentimes when we have women of color, girls of color, women and girls and men and boys of different class backgrounds, they don't always have the same voice. So although this is great and although we are getting this into the mainstream, I would like to see more done.
So as you know, we mentioned, or you had mentioned also about all the different celebrities that are coming to light with all these sexual allegations. Do you think it's challenging, or I guess even okay, to separate a celebrity from their art to their personal life? Because I know that's something, like, I love Louis C.K., for example, and now I feel like I can't watch him just because it's very cringe-worthy type comedy, which again, like, kind of alludes to everything that's been going on in his life. But do you think there's an ability to separate the art from the person?
Well, Ryan was saying he's never going to watch House of Cards now.
Yeah. No, is the short answer. Mm-hmm. And I get this a lot in hip-hop and feminism, in particular talking about people like R. Kelly, where it's, but he's such a great artist that, you know, he's such a great actor, or he's such a great comedian that we can somehow separate the work from the man. And I do think that that's what gets us into trouble a lot, because I think it's a level of complacency that we condone certain behavior in order to somehow bring out certain work, as if that work can't be brought out in different ways. So I know it's hard, and I have students who go, well, I love dancing to Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, or I love watching House of Cards. But part of that is profiting, that these actors are still able to maintain their level of celebrity because people are supporting them while they're still behaving in the way that they do. So unfortunately, for a long period of time, we have thought about not separating someone, or separating someone rather, and it's important that we actually see the person for the person and who they are and their true colors.
Yeah, how many years has it been since I've watched a Woody Allen movie?
Yep. And Woody Allen is one of those people. And there are still people that justify working with him because he has wonderful movies. He's a wonderful producer, wonderful director. But is he really that wonderful based on what he's done? And the answer is no, he's not.
How has your experience as a university administrator informed your research and teaching?
I was in residence life, and then after that in judicial services in D.C., and a lot of what I saw, or a lot of things that students talk to me about, is their double experiences as a college student. So their interaction with me as an administrator was very different from their interactions with their faculty members, that somehow they felt as though their faculty members were not approachable, that you go to your faculty member for schoolwork, you go for exams, that's what you do, and then you are quick to leave. I don't consider myself a counselor. However, I realize that students' experiences outside of my classroom impacts their experiences in my classroom. And I don't think it's as easy to separate the two. So oftentimes, I have no problem with speaking to students outside the academic framework that we're looking at, and how our coursework might be actually interacting with their experiences. And this is why some people have that visceral reaction, because they come to my classroom not realizing that some of what we're going to talk about is going to touch them in a different way that they didn't expect it to.
On all of our syllabuses now at UD, there has to be, I don't know, like a disclaimer or some kind of, I don't even know what to call it, but information that you can go to your professor, and your professor is required to not talk about it with other people. Mm-hmm. And does that create a sense of more like approachable professors? Do you think that is a good thing?
It does, depending on how it's delivered. Right. So I think sometimes a syllabus can look like a contract, and the wording can be very formal. So students don't always feel the informal part of going to a faculty member, right? If your faculty member stands up in front of the classroom and is in and out, and that's it, I think the personality matters as well. So although there are those notes on the syllabus, that doesn't always mean that those notes are then transferable to actually happening.
Thank you for sitting down with us today, Dr. Christopher Bird.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.
Mm-hmm.